Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Erica Faubourg on behalf of Plaintiff's Appellants. Your Honors and opposing counsel, we're requesting that this Court overrule the lower court on the following grounds: that the denial of plaintiff's motion to amend was an abuse of discretion, and further, that plaintiff's complaint was well pleaded, therefore the grant of the motion to dismiss was an error. At issue in this case is the validity of the enforcement of Chicago Municipal Code 940-260, the cell phone ban. Essentially, this law prohibits driving in the city while talking on a cell phone unless you're using a hands-free device. It is a primary offense. It means you can get pulled over solely for a violation of that ordinance. The fines range from $75 to $200. Plaintiffs, in their original complaint and in the motion to amend, raised several claims that challenge the constitutionality of the manner in which this ordinance is being enforced.
You know, my very first question when I read your brief was this. If a municipality is not required to post all ordinances related to driving, what is the test that you would propose for a court to determine which ones require such notice to the driving public?
Well, Your Honor, that question actually has been answered by the Illinois Vehicle Code. A municipality can enforce and enact any law, traffic regulation or otherwise, so long as it is not in conflict.
But, of course, your Illinois Vehicle Code claims have been preserved because the district court simply declined to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over that claim, dismissed it without prejudice, and if you wish to go forward with it, you can do so.
That's true, Your Honor. Just to get to the answer, it's that the policy seems to weigh in favor of posting notice of signs when people would have no idea that they're traveling into an area that they may be doing something that's prohibited. But that's where the notice issue does come in, not only with the claims that were raised in the original complaint, but in the motion to amend, which includes substantive due process rights. So when an ordinance would infringe on substantive due process rights, at least on the federal question, is when we would state that's when notice should be given in the form of signs.
I have to say, I find much of your theory almost incomprehensible. The notion that the right to travel is the same thing as the right to drive a car is my first problem, since there are all sorts of regulations on driving a car, and some people drive cars, other people don't drive cars. Driving a car is a privilege that the state confers if you pass appropriate tests, and if you don't have adequate vision or adequate knowledge of the rules of the road, you can't get a driver's license, and so on and so forth. So I just don't think there's anything to this theory of yours that this has anything to do with right to travel. With respect to notification, it really does, as you just said, look like an Illinois Vehicle Code case that the state courts are entirely free to entertain as you wish. If you think the Vehicle Code requires the city of Chicago to put up great big signs on virtually every street as you're crossing over from Evanston into Chicago or wherever, then you can present that. If that Illinois law, I presume, could require that if it wanted to. But there are no end of local regulations that people are simply required to know, and they could get a ticket if they don't know them.
Well, and that knowledge of the local regulations is only imputed to those individuals who reside in the area.
No, it is not. It's imputed to everybody. So if your mother comes to visit from Texas and she's driving around Chicago, she can't use a cell phone while she's driving, and it's imputed to her just as much as it's imputed to you.
Well, and respectfully, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has stated that when the prohibited conduct is innocent, such as talking
Why
on a cell
phone. Why is it innocent?
Do you think
drunk driving is innocent?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Isn't something that distracts your attention from the road, whether it's putting your makeup on while you're driving or whether it's, you know, searching around for something on the floor of your car while you're driving? No, that's innocent. You can be looking for something that you dropped or talking on a cell phone. I think that that's a conclusory characterization of the conduct.
Well, I think specifically that the state itself has refused to or has denied at this point to enact a law that would be statewide prohibiting cell
phone use. I place no weight on that whatsoever. Some municipalities have, others haven't. The city of Chicago has.
And therefore, you know, the fact that others have not and other states have not does show that it's not a per se bad conduct. That
and nor is a speed limit of 30 or 35. Some cities have 25. Some people have 35. But you're supposed to abide by whatever the local rules are.
And generally there are signs posted
here and there,
notice of speed
limits.
Not
every 5 feet.
Let me ask you this. If a municipality has an ordinance prohibiting drunk driving and setting the blood alcohol limit at 0.05, whereas the limit in the rest of the state is generally 0.08, would that be an unconstitutional restriction on the right to travel under your analysis unless the municipality posted signs setting forth that blood alcohol standard?
Your Honor, not in the same sense in that because there would be, and there is in this state, and I believe every state in the union, a statewide law against drunk driving. Drivers
but,
are...
But my
question is the amounts, not...
Understanding that is that at least they have some notice that they're engaging in conduct that is likely to be prohibited.
Not
in
at all. I think you give away your whole case if you answer Judge Rovner's question as you just did. Because somebody would either have 2 beers or 3 beers. And if it's 0.05, it's a lower blood alcohol content, and you got nabbed even though you would have past the 0.08. Maybe you even have a little thing in your car you can blow into, and you blow into it, and it says 0.75, and you think, aha, I'm safe. And you go out and you get arrested.
Well, my response would be the average citizen does not know if they're going to have 1 beer or 2 beers, how that will affect their blood alcohol.
But they're supposed to.
But they would know absolutely that picking up a cell phone is or is not prohibited.
They are also supposed to know the difference between 0.08 and 1. And 0.1, which was a change that was made a few years back.
Well, and, you know, not to labor on this point, but the fact is that we all know, not just because it's a law, but because there are signs, there are public notifications everywhere, drinking and driving, without at all relating to the amount of blood in your system is ingrained in us that it is an illegal act.
Well, I would say the same thing is probably true of seatbelt laws. The same thing is true of these cell phone laws. There's not a person who's walking around in today's world, unless they're really asleep, who hasn't been menaced by people who are paying attention to their cell phones and not their driving. Or people who are walking across the street in the cell phones and not paying any attention to the fact that somebody is trying to make a turn.
And in fact, I mean, you could almost take judicial notice of the fact that there are more lunatics out there with cell phones making left turns and doing their nails and God only knows what else than there are drunk drivers.
Well, and Your Honor, I personally, the policy of this law I stand behind, and we have never attacked the policy. The policy is sound. The problem is that we're not allowing people to conform to the law. We're not giving any notice whatsoever.
I don't think that's right. The city has taken steps to have public information announcements. It publicized it widely when the law came into effect. There are efforts to make this clear. I think you're overstating your case when you say none.
Well, on behalf of the plaintiffs, two of the three original named plaintiffs and the proposed plaintiff, none of these individuals lived in Chicago, and none of them were aware that the cell phone law was in effect.
Now, there's another thing here, which is you should be glad that the city didn't plead res judicata, because when the plaintiffs had their proceedings before the city, they had an opportunity to raise these points that you are talking about in those proceedings.
That is true, and I will say that, well, Joseph Fosco and Angela Hsu, both for reasons that had nothing to do with the ordinance, but rather for the inability for them to actually contest their tickets, paid their tickets.
And they had an opportunity at that time, if they thought this was an unconstitutional law, to tell the authorities that and have that adjudicated. But anyway, I don't understand that the city has raised this. They just got it dismissed on the pleadings.
You know, you do not challenge the district court's holding that the officers were entitled to qualified immunity on the Fourth Amendment claim. Given that waiver, is there anything to be gained by having the court address the Fourth Amendment?
What I will say is that during the briefing on this, and it was an extensive briefing schedule, it did become clear that there may be some problems with the defense of qualified immunity. And that is something that we did recognize both in our brief to this court and in the lower district briefing. But that is precisely why we took the time and as quickly as we could. Now, one of the reasons Judge Castillo raised was that we were dilatory in bringing our motion to amend. The briefing schedule ended on April 21st. Joseph Fosco retained us on May 23rd, and we brought our motion June 6th, less than 2 weeks later. That was as quickly as we could get the pleading on file.
But this is a civil case, and I looked at the transcript on that. Yeah. Judge Castillo had established a different schedule for the case, and it's not like the plaintiffs were not entitled to change lawyers, but the lawyers couldn't expect that the judge was going to amend his entire schedule for the proceedings.
Well, at that stage, there had been no trial schedule. There was no discovery that had begun at all. There's just no delay. There's no prejudice. There's no surprise to defendants. And Rule 15 does call for liberal grant of motion to amend. And there's just no reason to not allow at that stage an amendment to the complaint that would allow plaintiffs to plead a federal claim that was valid and affected fundamental rights.
Well, the court says, I mean, he's just not impressed with this. You know, Mr. Horwitz says, no one noticed it, no one paid attention to that issue, and the judge says it's in my discretion, I'm using my discretion to deny the motion. You amended on January 25th, 2008. He said, I would have asked. There was a briefing schedule, and he didn't think much of the theories anyway, so...
Well, and unfortunately, we don't have the transcript from that hearing, so I am not aware of.
It's
well,
in your brief.
No, not that hearing. I'm sorry, the original hearing of the briefing schedule being set.
I mean, the bottom line is that the district court felt that the claims themselves were without merit, so.
Well, and I will state that specifically on the right to travel issue, they got that 100% wrong. He verbatim.
You are not raising a right to travel point. You're raising a right to drive a car point. There are people all over New York City who don't even have driver's licenses. They never drive a car because you'd be a lunatic to do it in Manhattan. And they travel all the time. They travel interstate. They go over to Connecticut, to New Jersey. It's just not the same thing.
And I would state that generally, and I see my rebuttal just to finish on this point, generally right to travel is dealing with residency requirements. 90% of the case law that we came across dealt with that. But this is a novel approach. It has been dealt with in other courts. It has been dealt with in district courts outside of the Seventh Circuit with very similar laws dealing with traveling through a city where an ordinance made conduct illegal that was not illegal
throughout
the state.
But you don't have a single court of appeals case that has said that a local cell phone ordinance violates this somewhat ambiguous federal constitutional right to travel. None.
Your Honor, we could not find one on record throughout the country.
And I'm not a bit surprised, actually. But anyway.
I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Norberg.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Ms. Shore and her co-plaintiffs, as counsel has represented today, do not dispute that the city has a legitimate interest in protecting the public safety, nor do they dispute that there is a rational basis for having an anti-cell phone ordinance towards that end. In fact, as counsel said today, they agree or concede that the policy is sound and that it is a legitimate method of deterring conduct that would possibly lead to a harm to the public interest. Nevertheless, they present four claims under the Constitution, none of which have merit. This morning I'd like to focus on the Fourth Amendment and equal protection claims, and the city, unless you have specific questions, will rest on its brief.
I'd like to just ask you this. If no other municipalities had ever restricted the use of phones in vehicles, would there still be no constitutional problem, even though an out-of-town driver would have no reason to believe it was a problem? For instance, if Chicago decided that even passengers talking on the phones was distracting and banned that, would the driver who is fined have no recourse, even though she had no way of knowing that could be unlawful?
There could conceivably be some sort of due process claim that might be brought, but in this case, it's clear that there is this isn't some sort of secret legislation, as Judge Wood was describing. This is a situation where the city has followed a trend across many states, many municipalities, at making a specific type of conduct while driving illegal, and that is using a handheld cell phone. So this isn't.
Aren't a lot of traffic ordinances anyway essentially strict liability ordinances? So I'm thinking of another example. Suppose the city of Chicago decided that it was going to have a curfew for teen drivers that went all the way up through the age of 19. There are a lot of such curfews around. People age 16 can't be out after 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. And if Chicago had such an ordinance, and somebody who's visiting from Texas,
they're always from Texas.
Of course they are. Somebody's
from
visiting
Texas.
From Texas. I've brought a lot of people from Texas into Chicago. And a 19-year-old is driving at 11 o'clock at night and is arrested. Is there any problem with that? There are no signs, I'm postulating, nothing. City of Chicago just has a curfew, and the person is violating the local rules.
There's no constitutional dimension to that issue. There would not be a constitutional problem with that.
Even though there's no notice, or you don't drive down the street and say you have to be off the road by 10 if you're under the age of 20 or anything like that.
Insofar as the ordinance, as it is in this case, is duly enacted, created by the municipality, there may be conceivably some sort of state law implication, which arguably, according to plaintiffs, there is here. If the state for some reason has decided to impose notification requirements on municipalities, then perhaps it would run afoul of that. But there's simply just not a constitutional dimension to this. And the fundamental problem with what plaintiffs are saying in this case is that they purport to create a rule whereby the ineffectiveness of an ordinance because of a violation of state law or an alleged violation of state law creates a predicate from which a plaintiff can make a constitutional claim, specifically here a Fourth Amendment and an equal protection claim. Basically, their argument is that because as a matter of state law, this ordinance is ineffective, it therefore could not provide probable cause for stopping someone who's violating the ordinance, and therefore that's the Fourth Amendment aspect, and it also could not provide a legitimate basis for distinguishing between violators and non-violators, the equal protection aspect. Now, there are two major problems with that. The first is the one we've already begun discussing, and that is that this is a state law issue, it does not have a constitutional dimension. The Constitution does not demand that municipalities follow state law. The Constitution could care less with regard to whether or not municipalities follow state law. What the Constitution is concerned with is whether or not the laws or the conduct of states or municipalities violates the Constitution.
And could I ask you a question about the consequences? Obviously, a violation of this ordinance is something that can lead to a fine. I understand $75 right at this point. Are there other consequences? So, for example, do you get points on your driver's license, or is it considered a moving violation for insurance purposes or anything else like that?
Well, I have to give two answers there, and I feel like I'm up here defending ordinances more than once in the past, and I hate to present a moving target, but the fine is actually $100 now.
And now it's $100. Okay.
It's gone up as of February.
Oh, up to $200?
It goes up to $500 now, actually, Judge Rovner.
Oh, if I'm glad I know this.
If there is an accident that results from the violation as well. And with regard to whether or not there are points or any other sort of collateral effects, the answer is no. This is not something that affects any sort of state licensing rights or any sorts of
issues. So it's more like parking in front of a fire hydrant than it is like driving 70 miles an hour in a 55 zone?
That's exactly right. And similar to a case that we're in this court very recently, the Idris case, which is that case involved the red light camera ordinance.
Oh, yes, right.
And in that case, as in this case, this is a situation where it is essentially much more analogous or comparable to a to a parking violation than it is to any sort of state law prohibited moving violation. So the fact is that not only and another important point to make, which Judge Wood, I believe you touched on when counsel was up here, is that the state court issue has not been addressed in this case, the state law issue, rather. The district court determined that this was a state law issue that was relatively novel and should be left to the state courts. So it is an unestablished premise that the ordinance runs afoul of state law to begin with. So even on their own terms, the plaintiff's argument here cannot succeed. They do not have the established premise that it does violate state law. Therefore, even if it was relevant to the constitutional inquiry, whether or not it violated state law, it's a non-starter.
So does that make this, in a sense, premature? Because suppose the state court were to decide that the Illinois Vehicle Code requires posting of signs about this on every street that crosses a border between a suburb in Chicago and then every so many feet down that street, kind of like speed limit signs. I mean, every so often you have to remind people of what the speed limit is. Wouldn't that put the notice issue in a very different posture than the notice issue would be in if the state court were to decide you don't really need to put any signs up at all, for example?
Insofar as the notice issue impacts anything that the plaintiffs have claimed in this case, perhaps, but there really is no notice claim in this case other than a misguided right to travel claim that for some reason contemplates the issue of whether or not there is notice of the law as somehow informing the determination of whether or not having a law against talking on a handheld cell phone while driving violates the right to travel. But yes, I mean, conceivably, if there was going to be some sort of due process claim, the determination of notice might have something to do, although ultimately would run into the problem that the fact that a state determines that a certain amount of notice is necessary does not mean that the Constitution requires that.
Right, but the Constitution
notice is
probably going to put a floor. I mean, the state can always give more, and if, as I, in my two extremes, if the Illinois Vehicle Code says zero posting is fine, that's one possibility, and the federal question would be, does that satisfy the minimum for federal standards? If the Illinois Vehicle Code requires signs plastered all over the place, then it would, at least the posture of the federal case would be different. One would expect the city to be arguing that it has exceeded whatever standards may exist as a federal matter.
Yes, I think that's right. I think the fact is that as a matter of law, the determination by the state courts or the state or under state law what sort of notice is required does not change or move the constitutional floor.
No, but it does. It would help one know whether the city was complying with the constitutional minimum or not, because if the state law doesn't require any signs, then maybe there is some question. If the state court requires a medium number, 50 signs, 100 signs, a million signs, where the facts turn out, I'll put it, after the state law has been applied, would then be of some relevance, it seems to me, to the federal question.
I think that's probably fair, but as you said, that would need a state court determination in order to...
Right, which is why I said maybe this part's premature.
Conceivably, although, just to anticipate what sort of notice argument under the Constitution might be presented against this ordinance, we would take the position, and this is not being argued in this case, because there is not, as I said, the only notice argument presented by plaintiffs has some sort of obscure relationship with their right to travel claim. But were they to make some sort of due process notice claim that the application of this law to them without sufficient notice is unconstitutional, we would argue that the Constitution does not require any specific amount of signage, any specific form of notice. All it requires is sufficient notice, and that by its nature, lawmaking at the municipal level, at any level, involves introduction of possible laws, the passage of those laws, the publication of those laws, and the enforcement of those laws. And if the laws are on the books, that is, as a general matter, and in this case, sufficient to satisfy the constitutional notice requirements.
So this may be your career case.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I hope not.
Wow. Sure sounds like it.
Onward and upward, Judge Robner, I would hope. So what we're left with here with regard to the Fourth Amendment and due process claims from the city's perspective is a Fourth Amendment claim where there was clearly probable cause to stop the plaintiffs.
Well, they concede that.
Which is conceded because it's conduct concededly violates the ordinance. And with regard to the equal protection claim, a classification that is being drawn between two classes which are clearly not similarly situated, that is a class of people who are talking on their handheld cell phones while driving, thereby violating the law, and everybody else who is not violating the law. Clearly the Constitution does not require the city to treat those people the same. So unless you have any further questions, I will rest my brief with regard to the rest of the issues. Thank you. We ask you to affirm the decision of the district court.
Okay. Ms. Paper? Okay.
Just very briefly, Your Honors. Here we have a fundamental issue of fairness, not just the fairness of not notifying citizens of other municipalities outside of Chicago or other states.
But, you know, I'm not even sure of that, because I was reflecting that when you travel to another state, you assume the burden of figuring out what that state's or city's or county's traffic laws are. It's certain the burden is on the person who comes into the jurisdiction. You get a little message from the American Automobile Association or the state. You have to. It's just up to you. So I don't know why you think the burden lies on the other side.
Well, generally the burden is on knowledge to know the state law, but not generally on the municipal law.
Why not? What possible distinction is there if you're a driver entering a different jurisdiction where you don't live, not to find out whether in some places it might be county laws, in some places it might be city or municipality laws regarding use of the roads. You are engaged in a privilege. You're using the roads. I don't know where you have law that says the burden is on the municipality.
Well, specifically, the Ramirez case, which is cited in our initial and reply brief, does deal with a case where there was a state law prohibiting conduct of a certain amount of window tinting, and the city law said, okay, well, we're going to even restrict that further. There, you were only applying the law to residents of the state, to vehicles that were registered
right,
in the state.
Right, that's the Western District of Tennessee, and these vehicle tint laws, actually, the police don't like them for drug dealers and the like. I mean, they're a different kind of law.
Well, in here we
I'm
have
not sure we're bound by the Western District of Tennessee anyway.
Well, you certainly are, but it is one of the very few cases that's dealing with these unique issues. But there are six states, and excuse me, I will briefly conclude, that prohibit cell phone driving in this country. But at bottom, there's the notion of fairness to the plaintiffs to have been given the right to amend at such an early stage in the proceedings. And for those reasons, we would ask that you reverse the court on those grounds. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.